You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, doctors can now save lives using body parts that don't come from humans. But there are lots of ethical and regulatory issues tied to transplanting animal organs into human bodies. Jen White talks to cutting-edge surgeons about xenotransplantation. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a group of researchers has found that poverty intervention early in life can actually have a positive impact on infants' brains. Infants in the study whose parents received a direct cash gift of $333 a month had better brain development a year into life than infants whose parents received $20 a month. We're talking about this new research, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. This research happens to come out after the expiration of a tax credit that was part of a COVID relief package. Did you benefit from that? Did it help you do things to take care of your family? Would you like to see it be made permanent? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guests are on the research team for the study on poverty intervention called Baby's First Years. Sonia Troller-Renfrey is a postdoctoral research associate at Teachers College, Columbia University. Sonia is also a graduate of UW-Madison. Sonia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Sarah Halpern-Meekin is Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, let's start with you. Can you talk about a big picture? This is a unique, first-of-its-kind study. What makes it unique?
Well, we know that there's an association between income and how families do, child development, those sorts of things. But it's really hard from a scientific perspective to say whether that income causes those outcomes for children and families. And so this is one of the first studies that really allows us to get at that causal question. Does income cause differences in children's development?
Can you lay out the basics of how you and your colleagues tried to figure that out?
Sure. So in this study, we worked with partners across four metropolitan areas in the United States, in New York City, Omaha, Nebraska area, New Orleans, and in the Twin Cities, a variety of areas that vary in their policy environment, the cost of living, the demographics of their population. And we went into hospitals, actually, and invited mothers 24 to 48 hours after they'd given birth to take part in a study on children's development. We were able to have 1,000 mothers agree to be part of the study. After they agreed to be part of the study, we asked them if they would be willing to be randomly assigned to receive a large or a small monthly cash gift. The large gift group receives $333 a month, and the small gift group receives $20 a month. And in our study, we use that difference between the $20 group and the $333 a month group to get that causal identification that we're interested in.
So, Sonia, here we are with our first measurements of this. You looked at the brainwaves of the infants in the study. First of all, can you tell us what brainwaves are and what they tell us about that early child development?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you think about how do you look under the hood to see how a little baby is developing, it can be a little bit of a tricky task. Now, what EEG is, how we measure brain waves, is a way of looking at how the brain is communicating. So you may know that one way that your brain cells talk to each other is by sending little electrical signals from one brain cell to the other. And when those little electrical signals are sent, some of that electricity actually escapes and travels all the way up to the scalp. And we can actually measure it just by putting a funny cap on kids' heads. And so how that works is there are little discs on the cap that we call electrodes, and they work sort of like how your voice would go into a microphone, but instead it's your brain waves going into these electrodes. And why we like EEG is it's really, really friendly to babies. We just put on a funny cap, but they can move around, they can sit on their parents' lap while we take the recording. Another reason why we like EEG is we know a little bit about how EEG develops during the first few years of life. So we know when a baby is born, they have more what we call low frequency or slower brain activity. But as they get older, there seems to be an increase in what we call faster brain activity or high frequency brain activity. And so because we know how the brain develops, we can think about how kids may differ from one another by looking at how much low frequency brain activity or slow brain activity they have compared to how much high frequency or faster brain activity they may have.
All right, so here we are, Sonia. You've got these infants with funny hats on their heads. What did you find when you looked at their brainwave activity and compared the ones who were in the two separate groups, the ones getting the $20 a month payments versus the ones getting the $330 a month payments?
That's a great question. So one of the hypotheses we had was that the infants who were in the group where the mothers received more money or the bigger cash gift, we hypothesized that they might show more of this fast brain activity compared to infants of the mothers who were in the low cash gift. So that's actually, we saw some evidence for that. Particularly, these findings provide evidence that after just about 1 year of monthly unconditional cash support, the mothers in the high cash gift group, their infants showed more fast-paced brain activity in key areas of the brain that other research has shown to support thinking and later learning.
We are talking about a new study called Baby's First Years. It's an ongoing study, I should say. Sonia Troller-Renfrey is with us from Teachers College, Columbia University, and Sarah Halpern-Meekin with UW-Madison. Part of the study giving low-income families different amounts of money, seeing how brains and cognition develop among their children. Sonia, before we bring in Sarah for some of the wider implications here, what would be the next things you'd want to look at? We've got these brainwave differences between the two groups, a good sign. What would you want to be looking for in the future to see if things, if changes are lasting?
That's a great question. One of the first things that I think I would like to look at is, you know, right now we took this measurement at 1 year of age. Our next step is actually to take this measurement again when these children are 4 years of age to see if we see the same pattern. Also at 4 years of age, we'd love to look and see if there are any differences in thinking and learning by doing really explicit cognitive tasks. Right now we say we might think there's association based on sort of broader science, but we don't know that for sure until we actually explicitly test cognitive functioning when kids are 4 years old. And then the final thing that we'd love to look at is, you know, of course, there's a sort of indirect path from money to the child, right? So cash doesn't just go into the brain. It gets into the brain likely by changing the environment this baby's in. And so starting to think about what may have changed in the environment that may have resulted in these differences we see is another question we would love to think about.
We're going to call her now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. First one, what was the magic amount of money? You talked about a lesser amount and a greater amount. Was there an amount that was in between that would be more effective, or would it require even more than the $300 that you gave? And then my second question was, I lost my train. Oh, yes. For the families that had the greater amount of money, what were they doing differently than from the families that had the lesser amount?
Sarah, let's bring you. Thanks for that question, Mark. Let's bring you in, Sarah. Now, first of all, there were just the two amounts. There wasn't a gradation where you'd mark a threshold. It was just the 20 or 333, as I understand it. But what do we know, or at least what would we want to know about what that extra 300 some bucks meant for those families?
Right. So I think what the caller is getting at is why those amounts of money, right? And these amounts were chosen based on what we know from existing research from both correlational and quasi-experimental research that indicates that that amount of money between $3,000 and $4,000 a year, which some lower income families would get from, say, their tax refund from the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit, that that amount of money can make a difference for how things things go for families. But that amount of money is delivered through tax refunds just once a year. And so this experiment lets us see what happens when families don't have to wait for that once a year big check, but rather they get the money every month to help meet those monthly expenses if that's how they choose to use it. So that's how the amount of money was chosen based on existing research. And then the caller's second question was really getting at, I think, Sonia's last mm-hmm. point, which was, we're interested in those mechanisms, and that is one of the next things we're exploring in the study. How is it that money makes a difference for families?
Thanks for the call, Mark. We're talking to researchers Sonia Troller-Renfrey, neuroscientist from Teachers College, Columbia University, and Sarah Halpern-Meekin, sociologist at UW-Madison, about the study they're part of on how poverty interventions can affect babies' brain development. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with researchers Sonia Troller-Renfrey and Sarah Halpern-Meekin. They're both part of a study called Baby's First Years, looking at how direct poverty intervention affects babies' brain development, giving cash payments to low-income families and seeing how they affect brain outcomes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Sarah, based on what you've learned so far, I know there's some more to come. Do you have thoughts on policy implications?
So policy, you know, is made based on the weight of the evidence. And so I don't want to see policy get made on the basis of any one study. I think what our study helps to do in having a broader conversation about how income matters and how we can think about as a society investing in children is oftentimes those conversations get stuck on parents' behavior. So what does it mean to give families money? Well, what about those parents? And this study that Sonia's really led us in has helped us to see that we can move this conversation away from focusing exclusively on parents' behavior, and we can look at how money benefits kids. There's a really limited way that we can examine how, you know, one-year-olds are developing because they're little and they can't do all that much. And so some of the things that Sonia has helped to develop for how we can better understand children's brain development, I think can help us move that conversation to saying, how does money matter for kids without focusing on parents?
Let's go back to our callers now. Peter is with us in Kewaunee. Peter, hi.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead, Peter.
Not to stay on subject, but just a thought pattern. I'm sorry. I just feel as though the socialistic factor of our Democratic Party is trying to buy backwards from the college students being socialized into free monies to now the parents to now babies. Where's this free money coming from? It seems to be coming through a flow of our system.
But we lost Peter. Peter, I think, raising concerns about social spending like this. Either of you want to talk about that and but how it fits into the work you're doing.
Sure. In the case of this study, the funding is coming through philanthropic organizations. That's who's funding the cash gifts to families. I think we often think about money as something that only certain families get, but really we have resources that go out to all families, all individuals. You know, we benefit from having roads, from public schools, public libraries. So there's a whole variety of ways that we infuse resources into communities to allow us to live the lives that we do and to live together. So I don't think this is really about redistributing all resources and, you know, taking government control of production, which is what socialism is about. This is about thinking about how we invest in development for children. And we do that in some ways through having public education, through having safe parks for children to play in. And we're in this study thinking about some of the other ways that we can also invest money in children. This is not an uncommon thing. There are lots of countries like Canada, for example, that have different kinds of child allowances or child benefits. And so this isn't far off from those sorts of things or from the child tax credit that we've long had in place in the United States.
And Sonia, can you talk about the efforts to find ways to measure the impacts of these kind of interventions, which is a huge part of what you did in this research?
Yeah, especially when we're focusing on children, one of the things that's really interesting is you can really only assess what that child can do or what you can sort of get based on their developmental age, right? So when we think about measuring what a 12-month-old knows, that's can be very difficult. But as kids get older, they can start telling us more about their experience, both by sort of what their day-to-day life looks like, but also we can start doing, the examination of skills like pre-literacy or math skills. And so it's our hope to follow these kids across their development and really get a deep understanding of what cash support or unrestricted cash support in the first few years of life may do for development.
And Sonia, how long are you hoping to be able to follow this this cohort of kids?
That's a great question. I think, any researcher like myself would love to follow them all the way to adulthood. Of course, it always takes a big team and lots of strategic planning to do so. So right now, our next planned assessment is at 4 years of age, and we're starting to think about new assessments maybe at 6 and 8 years of age, but those aren't all fully planned yet.
Time for one more caller. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hello.
Hi. My question relates to what the root cause of the effect might be. Is it potentially better nutrition or more interactive childcare? Have you made any attempt to look at why the money is causing the positive effects that you've seen in your studies?
Oh, great question there, Sarah. And I imagine it's pointing toward future parts of the research here.
Yeah, so we would love to know the answer to Dick's question. It's a question that's on the top of our mind. So we're working hard to try to figure out the answer. And part of the answer involves analyzing the data we already have. And part of the answer involves continuing to collect and analyze data as the children grow up. We think in part that it could also just differ for different families. Different families have different needs, different values, and different priorities. And giving them money in this way that doesn't require them to use it in any particular way allows them to tailor their spending to their own needs. And so there might be a whole variety of things that families are doing that are important.
Look forward to seeing more results. We'll leave it there. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And Sonia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Sonia Troller-Renfrey is a postdoctoral research associate at Teachers College, Columbia University. And Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. We've been talking about their study, Baby's First Years, part of a big team working on this. It looks at cash grants for low-income families and how they can affect infants' brain development. Now it's time for another part of WPR's series this week, hearing from Wisconsinites about their experiences during the COVID-19 pandemic.
My name's Jackie Cutts, and I currently live in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I worked frontline from a public health standpoint on pandemic response for 2020 and all through 2021. You work all the time, and you think about it when you're not working, and it was kind of this all-encompassing thing where you just want to help people and save lives and try to guide the community through this really intense, awful experience, but then find that the very people you're trying to help, some of them are the people who don't just not want help, but they hate you for it. I still have no regrets, and I'm fiercely proud of the work that I did with my team in 2021, but there's only so many times you can be swore at and yelled at and called names and received death threats. There's only so much of that before it kind of starts to wane on you, even if you know that what you're doing is the right thing.
My name is Kyle from DeForest, Wisconsin. I live with my wife and my 2-year-old daughter. When the pandemic began, we did only want to see people outside. So we were outside on our patio. My wife and I had chairs on one side with our daughter And my mother and my stepfather were on the other side. And that, I'm sure, was very heartbreaking that she couldn't hold her granddaughter. She didn't want to wear a mask. My mother and my sisters like to live their lives as if COVID-19 isn't really happening. So every time that we visited since then, it was the same thing. We have to be outside. And that was fine until the winter months hit. At that point, the vaccines were just coming out. And I was so excited. But then after talking to my sister, my mom decided, no, we're too hurt. We haven't seen our granddaughter or niece in 6 months. We don't think you're ready. And I couldn't believe it. I knew I was causing pain, but I just didn't know how hurt they were.
My name is Marita Stolenwerk. I have 3 children, a fifth grader and 2 fourth graders, and I currently live in Brookfield, Wisconsin. During the pandemic, I was a consultant for a national firm, and when I heard that we were going to lock down, I went to go talk to my manager and I cried. I said, I don't know how I'm going to do this and have the kids at home. I remember I was rehearsing to give a presentation with my colleagues, and my daughter sat behind me and screamed because she needed my help before she could submit an assignment, and I couldn't help her because I was busy. So in December of 2020, I decided that I would apply for another opportunity. And I felt very conflicted about leaving the position that I was in. I had worked really hard to be at that position, but I felt like I was failing in so many ways. It was a little bit of a pay cut, but it is more manageable in terms of me being able to be engaged with my family.
It's part of a series of WPR stories hearing from Wisconsinites about their experiences during the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll hear another installment tomorrow. Also coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it is official. Justice Stephen Breyer is leaving the U.S. Supreme Court later this year. We'll look at his career in the court, the road ahead to a new justice, and how the court's balance has changed in recent years. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. You may have heard about the health benefits of Mediterranean cooking. Now find out about the delicious benefits with the author of the new cookbook, Lemon, Love, and Olive Oil. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at a brand new poll from Marquette University and see how Americans feel about the U.S. Supreme Court, President Biden, vaccinations, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Packers saw a disappointing end to their season last weekend, and now many fans are asking if Aaron Rodgers will stay or if he'll go. We'll talk to the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel's Packers beat reporter about that and hear your thoughts. First, after more than 27 years in the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Stephen Breyer is planning to retire at the end of this term. Breyer is one of the court's 3 liberal justices. He's 83 years old. His retirement means Biden gets to appoint his successor and maintain the court's 6-3 conservative majority. The two addressed reporters at the White House earlier today. Biden talked about his plans for the nomination.
While I've been studying candidates' backgrounds and writings, I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first Black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue, in my view.
The news came out just as a new national poll from Marquette University Law School was coming out. It asked people how they felt about the Supreme Court, including Justice Breyer. It also got into issues like abortion, the Biden administration's performance, Congress, the 2024 presidential race, COVID-19 and vaccinations, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to Justice Breyer's resignation? What are you looking for in a replacement from President Biden? How do you feel about the current makeup of the court? Should justices declare their views on specific cases when they're getting confirmed? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get into some non-court related results in a little bit. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, we didn't know this was coming yesterday. You didn't know when you're out in the field with the poll, but you looked back at some of your polling where you asked people what they knew, what they thought of Supreme Court justices. Justice Breyer does stand out in kind of a weird way.
Well, he stands out consistently as the least well-known justice. We've been doing these national polls about the court since 2019, and in every one of them that we've asked, he has been the least well-known. In this current poll this month, only 21% were able to say whether they had a favorable or unfavorable view of him. Now, among those with an opinion, 14% said favorable and 7% unfavorable. So a 2-to-1 favorability rating, but of just this tiny 1/5 of the public. I think part of this stands out because while Breyer has been consistently a member of the liberal wing of the court, people on the left have focused far more on Sonia Sotomayor or earlier Ruth Bader Ginsburg as someone they paid attention to, and both of those justices were much better known. Sotomayor by 50% of the public in this latest poll. And on the right, Clarence Thomas stands out as the best known justice, and especially among folks to the right. So in these ways, you can kind of understand why Breyer would be little known. While he's this consistent liberal, he's not been the sort of focus of liberal attention, or for that matter, conservative opposition.
You know, stepping away from your poll for a moment, do you have thoughts on this 50-50 Senate majority? The Vice President, Kamala Harris, would be the tie-breaking vote, not filibusterable, if that's a word, under rules changes under former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. What are you looking at with the politics of this appointment?
Yeah, I think that it's likely that the Democrats hold together. While the Democrats have been split on some policy issues like the Build Back Better proposal, Democrats have been united in backing Biden's court appointments so far to other courts in the last year. So I expect that to hold together. I think a question would be if any of the Democrats have problems with the nominee, then that could produce real trouble. And secondly, it's a little unclear to what extent, if any, Republicans will try to delay a decision. I expect the confirmation to go through, but, you know, let's never say we know what the future is going to bring.
Now, these events, confirming a Supreme Court justice, very polarizing, at least in the Senate and the political world. When you polled Americans about what their views on the Supreme Court, did you find that kind of polarization reflected in any way?
Oh, we certainly do. We see it in approval of the job the court is doing, where approval has fallen from 66% approving back in 2020 before Justice Ginsburg's death to 60% this July, but then a sharp downturn to 49% in September, and it's slightly higher, 52% approving now. And not surprisingly, as with so many things, there's a bit of a partisan divide. 60% of Republicans approve, 45% of Democrats, with 52% of independents. So there is definitely a party divide there. And no doubt on a nominee and a confirmation hearing, we'll see sharp partisan divisions as well.
One of the big issues people are waiting for from the Supreme Court, a big case on abortion laws that could really potentially change things, could effectively overturn Roe versus Wade in the country. This is one of the issues you were polling people about, and you asked it a couple different ways, a couple different scenarios. What kind of things did you learn?
Yeah, and so it's complicated is the simple way to put it, because when we ask whether you would like to overturn Roe versus Wade, thus striking down the right to an abortion, only 28% of this national sample would like to see Roe struck down. 72% are opposed to striking it down. But the case that's before the court this spring is a Mississippi law establishing a ban on abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. That's about 9 weeks shorter than the current standard. But here the public is evenly divided. 49% would uphold that 15-week ban, and 51% would strike it down or oppose to it. Finally, Texas passed a law this summer, SB 8 it's called, which establishes a ban after effectively 6 weeks of pregnancy. And they are only 28% support that law, 72% are opposed to that law. So you see this sharp range from 72% support for maintaining Roe, but an even divide on a 15-week ban, but then 72% opposed to that 6-week Texas ban. So clearly with abortion, it matters a lot what the context is and what the limitations are that we're talking about in terms of whether the public supports or opposes those policies.
We're talking about the latest Marquette University Law School survey with Director Charles Franklin. We're going to move on to some other issues after the break, including how people around the country feel about President Biden's performance, about vaccinations, about whether former President Trump should run for re-election. We'll talk more about the retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer and the future of the Supreme Court tomorrow from 4 to 4:30. Right now, you could join us at 800-642-1234. Just listed a few of the topics. How do you feel about the job President Biden is doing? What do you want to see him do in his second year in office? Who would you like to see run for president, maybe on the Republican side in 2024? How big a threat do you think COVID-19 is to the nation, to your community? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the latest Marquette University Law School survey. They polled people from around the country on the U.S. Supreme Court, the 2024 presidential race, President Biden's performance, Congress, COVID vaccinations, and more. Charles Franklin stays with us, professor of law and public policy at Marquette, director of the poll. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll ask you a couple of the questions they asked Americans. Who do you want to see run for president on the Republican side? Do you want to see former President Trump try for another term in 2024? Do you see COVID as a big risk in your community? Why or why not? What do you think of the performance of President Biden and or Congress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. All right, just covered a lot of ground there, Charles. Let's start with the president's approval rating.
Yeah, that has fallen as it has steadily fallen in other polling since the summer. We have him down now at 46% approval. He was at 58% approval at the beginning of the summer. And so a pretty substantial decline. And that decline is across partisan groups. Most importantly, Biden has fallen by 13 points among Democrats since the summer, from 96 to 83. And he's fallen by 15 points among independents from 57 to 42. Republicans have been below 20% and it's bounced around but not really trended. So you can see that the Biden drop-off in job approval is really being driven in the Democratic and the independent categories and to about the same extent in both of those. The other thing was support among black respondents fell from 88% in July, declining each month we did the poll to now 57% approval in the January poll. Among Hispanic respondents, there's been very little change. And among white respondents, there was a drop by 10 points over the summer, but that's been stable in the late fall and now in January at just 40% approval.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jody joins us from Appleton. Jody, hi.
Hi. I have just wanted to say that I have voted Republican in the past and am just so tired of this Trump thing. If Republican Party supports him and he is back on, I will never vote Republican again.
Jody, thanks for the call. Charles, this is something you were asking people about. What did you find, especially amongst Republicans, or it sounds like Jody might be in that leans Republican party. She didn't say she always voted Republican. What did you find when you asked them about the idea of former President Trump trying to be future President Trump?
Well, the first thing is that President Trump remains very popular among Republicans, and that needs to be appreciated. Of Republicans, 74% have a favorable view of him, 25% unfavorable. But also among Republicans, 63% would like him to run again, 37% would not. And I think that gap between 74% favorable but 63% wanting him to run again shows a little bit of the divide here within the party, not across parties, but in the party. Donald Trump remains a very popular figure in the party, but the appetite for him running again is a bit less. Now, if we had a primary today, he'd be the odds-on favorite to win it, I think, but there is some shifting, and I think the reason we're asking these questions now is to try to understand the potential divisions within the party, exactly like the caller had to say. Where are the splits inside the traditional Republican Party, and how are Republicans looking on potential other candidates for 2024?
You floated one potential candidate that people are talking about, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, I think kind of as a test case for a non-Trump candidate. What did you find when you pulled Republicans for favorability and also then when you matched them up against President Biden?
Yeah, and in a matchup, in favorability, DeSantis is not nearly as well known as Trump at this point, but DeSantis gets a 52-11 favorable-unfavorable among Republicans. With Trump, it's 74-25, so there's more. But that Republican favorability is a 5-1 ratio for DeSantis and a 3-1 ratio for Trump. So DeSantis has the potential to grow a lot more favorability there. When we match up against Biden for this same reason, we see that DeSantis gets 33 to Biden's 41, and Trump gets the same 33, and Biden goes up a shade to 43%. So DeSantis, even as little known as he is right now, is running at least as well against Biden as Trump is. And within the party, DeSantis would get 81% of the Republican vote versus Biden, and Trump would get 77% against Biden. So again, DeSantis running at least as well as Trump.
And of course, it matters where votes are cast. This was a nationwide poll. Were you able to break down state by state?
No, we'll wait for the Wisconsin poll in a month or so to start looking here in Wisconsin.
Now, you also asked people about their thoughts on COVID-19, whether they thought it was a threat in their community. What kind of things did you hear?
The thing that is so striking here is maybe not surprising, but concern has fluctuated, has ebbed and flowed with the actual spread of the virus. So in September, when we were still at the high water mark for the last wave, the Delta wave of COVID, 68% said it was a serious problem. In November, when that wave was gone or largely gone and Omicron had not started, the serious problem dropped from 68 to 50%. But now with Omicron at its peak at the time we were in the field last week, 69% said it was serious. So these numbers do track the movement of the virus. And if we break it down and look at it state by state, we see that within states, the seriousness, the perceived seriousness, rises and falls with actual cases.
And briefly, the partisan split on that, just in our last half a minute.
Yeah, we see a pretty big split. Republicans currently say it's a 45% say it's serious. Independents say it's 64% serious. Democrats, 91% serious. So quite a big problem. or difference between them even right now at the peak of the virus.
Charles, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. And we talked to him today about the latest Marquette poll on national issues, including the U.S. Supreme Court, abortion, vaccinations, and the 2024 race for president. We'll talk more about the retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer and what comes next tomorrow at 4. More than 10,000 people in Wisconsin have died from COVID-19. This month's spike in infections saw more Wisconsinites hospitalized with the disease than at any time since the pandemic began. This week, WPR is sharing stories of how the pandemic has been felt by Wisconsinites in their own words.
My name is Terry Erdman. I'm 56 years old. I live in the Pulaski area in northeast Wisconsin. I'm a public school teacher, so our entire career got blown up in March of 2020. Going to virtual was extremely taxing. The end of June, I picked up COVID and I got real bad pneumonia. I was able to pull through that. And then about a month later, I kept having this pain in the top side of my heart. And we went to the long haul clinic in Green Bay for COVID. And the doctor there, she ran the EKG and she says, your right ventricle is not working correctly. So I was getting one good heartbeat, then a pause of longer than normal. And then my heart would do almost looks like a double beat. And it was making me extremely lightheaded, very forgetful. And it was scary. If things don't improve greatly, they're going to throw a pacemaker in me. And some people have told me, no big deal, pacemakers, I'm 56 years old. I really don't want to be connected to a battery the rest of my life. When you watch the news and you hear people saying that this is a hoax, this is just like the flu or the common cold, I'm like, yeah, for some people it is, and some people it's killing them.
I'm Cassandra Ambrosius. I live in Kronenwetter with my husband and our 11-month-old baby. I had COVID in December of 2020. I came down with what I thought was just a head cold, kind of bad sinus blockage. And then New Year's Eve, I went to eat a muffin and I was like, this muffin is stale, I can't taste it. And immediately had complete loss of taste and smell. I have had no return of anything in more than 12 months now. So, like, I've never smelled my own child, right? Like, in this time on Earth, I don't know what he smells like. But I think my brain has created an association with what I think the baby smell is like. So when I am around him and I smell him or I give him a kiss, like, I can sense that. It's almost like my brain has created a new smell association. But it's not actually there. Of the long hauler symptoms, I'm glad I can breathe. I'm glad I can still exercise and don't get winded. I'm glad I'm still here. So of course it could be worse, but I don't think anyone would be willing to lose their taste and smell.
She'eya Carol Dashajane. My name is Carol Schumacher. This is my Dene Navajo given name. I live in Sun Prairie. I'm originally from Arizona off the Navajo Dene Reservation. Early April, my sister ended up in the hospital. After a week, she wasn't getting any better and she got sent out because the small hospital on the reservation didn't know what to do. They weren't prepared for this virus. And then her son, my nephew, ended up getting sick. By late April, I had quite a few family members in the hospital. Like dominoes falling, it was just one after the other. In December of 2020, I lost 12 family members. It was three or four every weekend. We were putting them away, sending them off. No proper goodbyes, no proper service, trying to raise money for the cost, trying to understand this, trying to process our losses. My niece passed away January 10th of this year. That's 27 family members that we lost. This past summer, it hit me really hard how much this virus has altered our lives. Each day, I have a name I hold. Gee, Sam, Amelia, Nez, Gloria Smith, Herbert Benally,
so much more.
We'll hear more from Wisconsinites about their experiences during the pandemic later today and tomorrow here on Central Time. There's more to come on Central Time coming up on the Ideas Network.